Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of October. We had hoped this hour, and I hope we can track him down, to have the author of Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. Peter Galbraith is scheduled to be with us, and we just can't find him right now. He was the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia. He's the author of the New York Times bestseller, The End of Iraq, and is currently the senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and a contributor to the New York Review of Books. I don't know why I'm telling you all of this. I guess I hope that he's going to show up in the next couple minutes. He's written a very interesting book about Iraq, which really has not been front and center during the last few weeks because of the economic crisis. He writes extensively about the nuclear program that Iran has and the major thesis of the book that this war has really benefited Iran. And he talks about Pakistan being the world's most dangerous nuclear proliferator and says that the war that was intended to make America more secure has left the country weaker. So we hope to find Peter Galbraith sometime, and we will begin that conversation as soon as we find him. And the second hour of the program, John Katz, those of you who are animal lovers, he has a new book, Izzy and Lenore, Two Dogs, An Unexpected Journey, and Me. Izzy, you remember, is the border collie who was rescued, who had been really running wild for almost 3 years. And it's this remarkable story of how John and Izzy become hospice volunteers. And they work with so many people, older people, people with dementia, people with cancer, young people. And this dog, who has been wild for 3 years, has this uncanny ability to really bond with people in the last days or months of their lives. It's a beautiful story. And Lenore, of course, is this puppy, this Labrador puppy, who enters his life and is nothing but pure joy and pure love. And the new book is Izzy and Lenore. John Katz will be joining us in the second hour of our program. So that's what's happening during the course of this hour, and we will have our guest in about 1 minute, which is great. Okay, we're okay. Wasn't sure what I was going to do, but now we know what we're going to do. Tomorrow during this period, we'll be watching tonight's debate, listening to tonight's debate, which, of course, will be broadcast here on Wisconsin Public Radio, in case you want to listen as you're going into the kitchen to get some carrots and dip or whatever it is. Brownies, maybe, so you can watch the debate and listen to the debate as well if you're driving tonight, or if you prefer listening on the radio. Some people do. That's tonight, and it's at 8 o'clock. And then tomorrow during this time period, we'll be talking about tonight's debate. So that's what's up. And we have found Peter. Great. Latest book is Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join us on air today, or you can use the email address, and that's talk@WPR.org. Peter Galbraith, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. You know, it's interesting to me. You read your book and you think, oh my gosh, this is such an important issue. And then you look at what's happening in the presidential debate, and it is just a peripheral kind of conversation right now. And it's a crucial issue still, isn't it?
Of course it is. And the debate in the presidential election misrepresents what's going on in Iraq. And that's what bothers me enormously. Senator McCain simply asserts that the surge is a success, thanks to his early promotion of it. But he doesn't look at what success means.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a sharp decline in violence and a decline in the number of deaths of U.S. troops. Obviously, those are very welcome developments. But those are not actually primarily related to the surge, that is, the increase in the number of troops. But more importantly, success in Iraq is not a reduction in violence between Sunnis and Shiites, two groups that weren't fighting each other in 2003.
So
success has to be measured against our ability to accomplish our objectives.
What are our objectives?
Well, President Bush has defined our objectives as a democratic, stable, and unified Iraq. And Senator McCain has a slight variation on that, which is an Iraq that is a democratic ally. And by either standard, we are as far away now from that goal as we were when the surge began. In fact, I would argue even further.
Mm-hmm. You talk early in the book and through much of the book how the real winner in all of this is Iran. Can you talk more about that? How so?
Well, in 2002, President Bush described an axis of evil between Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, making a comparison to the World War II axis between Berlin and Rome. But, of course, at that time, there were no more bitter enemies in the world than Saddam Hussein and the Iran of the Ayatollahs. They had fought an 8-year war in the 1980s. But the U.S. came in, overthrew Saddam, dissolved his army, and paved the way for Shiite religious parties to take power in Iraq. These are parties that Iran has nurtured, funded, trained. They have militias that Iran trained, officered, armed. And they are the government of Iraq. The largest party in Iraq, which is called the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, was actually founded in Tehran in 1982 by Khomeini.
You talk about the fact that the Bush administration's goal of a unified, democratic, and stable Iraq is unattainable, that the strategies look at Iraq not simply as a whole, but as regions and ethnic sectarian communities. If it is unattainable, what in the world do we do in Iraq at this point? And why is it that we didn't look at all of this before we went into the country? That just is flabbergasting to me.
And flabbergasting to me as well. This has been the least strategic administration in memory. It substituted wishful thinking and ideology for careful analysis of the situation on the ground in Iraq and for prioritizing U.S. foreign policy objectives. So we went into Iraq and diverted our attention from much more serious problems of nuclear-armed or states seeking nuclear weapons, Iran, North Korea, Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they imagined, they saw Iraq not as it was, but as they wanted it to be. They thought of the Iraqis as the Germans of the Middle East. Once you got rid of their Hitler, they would be industrious, unified, create a modern, stable democracy, and that would in turn transform the rest of the Middle East. It was a lovely idea. It just had no connection to reality.
And you talk about, we're reminded when we read your book, of the people who were brought in to make the transition to work whatever this democracy was going to be, a number of very young Republicans who really didn't know, young people who really didn't know what was going on there very well. It was a mess.
Well, this is really staggering to me. Here was a project that would define President Bush's presidency, and of course involved a commitment of hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, hundreds of billions of dollars, and the people who were brought in to run Iraq in the after we took Baghdad in 2003 for the year-long occupation included scores of people who had no qualifications whatsoever. They were simply young Republican activists, people with good conservative credentials, but they had no experience in post-conflict situations, no knowledge of Iraq, never served or been in the Middle East. I cite one example, which to me just I can't comprehend. One of the things you want to do when you've gone into a country is you want to improve people's lives. You want them to think that the occupation, the American presence, is going to make things better for them. And for that, of course, you want to spend money, create jobs, start reconstruction. There was $11 billion in Iraqi government funds from oil sales. And they put in charge six young people in their 20s, none of whom had any experience in running government budgets, any experience in Iraq. They had been recruited because they had applied to a conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, and the Heritage Foundation had kept their names on file. And the Pentagon, the Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, instead of going looking in the U.S. government for qualified professionals, went to the Heritage Foundation for some ideas as to who could work on Iraq. One of these young people hadn't even finished college, and they were in charge of spending $11 billion. Of course, they spent a few hundred million, which meant that Iraqis reconstruction didn't take place, Iraqis didn't have jobs, and people became angry, and they ended up taking that anger out on American soldiers. People died because of this kind of irresponsible staffing.
Are those people still there?
Nope. They served usually 6 months to a year. This was incredibly lucrative because they got very high salaries to begin with, and then they received danger pay and all sorts of hardship pay. So, in effect, they would in about 6 months, they'd earn $180,000, which was the maximum amount you could pay U.S. government employees, and they'd have to leave. And these were people who were in their early 20s.
Can we go back? I'm not sure if this serves us well, but it intrigued me when I was reading you talk about Arabs of a certain generation and class remember a time when it never mattered, this is hard to believe, who was a Shiite, Sunni, or Kurd. Iraqis lived together, friendships crossed ethnic and sectarian lines, groups intermarried, and no one knew or cared who was a Sunni, a Shiite, or a Kurd. When was that, and is that a model in some way of what we ought to be striving for now, Peter?
I say that this is how certain Arabs, like Ahmad Chalabi and some of the real business and commercial and governmental elite, people who were associated with the monarchy, which was overthrown in 1958, this is how they remember the Iraq of their youth. In fact, this might have been true for their very narrow circles of a few hundred or a few thousand people, but it was not true of Iraq as a whole. For most Iraqis, even in those happy days of the monarchy in the 1950s, this was a country ruled by a Sunni dictator, in this case the king and the prime minister, who kept the Shiites down, who were the majority, and repressed the Kurds, who were in a continual state of rebellion. And so this is a false memory, but this memory was sold to the Americans as the true nature of Iraq.
And is there any way, we've heard of this plan when we've talked about this, and you write about maybe the only way to look at this is to look at a separation of these peoples, to look at different states. Is that what you may be suggesting for the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds, that this unification is something that may never be able to happen?
Well, Iraq was an artificial state put together by the British in 1921. Of three different provinces of the old Ottoman Empire that didn't have very much in common. And so it consisted of three communities, the Shiites who were in the south and who are today the majority in Iraq with about 60% of the population, the Sunnis who were at that time a majority in Baghdad but are not anymore, who are in the center, Anbar to Crete, Mosul, about 20% of the population, and the Kurds, who are about 20% of the population. And it never worked. As I said earlier, the Kurds were in continual rebellion, and successive Iraqi regimes responded with increasingly brutal pressure, ending in genocide in the 1980s. And the successive Iraqi governments denied the Shiites political power and kept their part of the country much poorer than the Sunni center. Today, you have... The country has already broken up, so I don't advocate breaking it up. I say this has already happened.
Mm-hmm.
Kurdistan in the north is, in all regards, an independent country. It has its own elected government. It flies its own flag. Until recently, it banned the flying of the Iraqi flag until the design of the flag was changed. It prohibits the Iraqi army from being on its territory. It has its own army. Kurds voted 98% for independence in a referendum in 2005. If you talk to an Iraqi Kurd and call him an Iraqi, he's insulted. But the Sunnis and the Shiites do think of themselves as Iraqi, but they have diametrically different visions of what Iraq should be. The Shiites would like to see it defined as a Shiite state, and they think their majority entitles them to rule. The Sunnis, including those who didn't like Saddam Hussein, still can't accept that Iraq would be defined as a Shiite state. So the divisions are very profound. The U.S. strategy has been to try and unify the country. That hasn't worked. It's tried to build up an Iraqi army without understanding that the Iraqi army and police are Shiite institutions. They're simply sectarian militias. we finally had success in Iraq, not because we sent more, or success, a reduction in violence, not because we sent in more troops in 2007, but because the Sunnis, who had been fighting the Shiites, had been working with al-Qaeda, decided they no longer wanted to do that. And we then agreed to fund a Sunni army. And it is the Sunni army that defeated al-Qaeda, not the Iraqi army. The unfortunate problem is that now there's a Sunni army that is there to challenge the Shiite army. This is the Awakening, this, or the Sons of Iraq, the Sunni militia of 100,000. So the elements for civil war remain. My argument is that, first, with regard to Kurdistan, we should accept that that is a separate place. So we there's no practical way to get it back into Iraq. So let the status quo remain. Between Sunnis and Shiites, the progress that we've made is because we have adopted, what was Senator Biden's plan for three states. We've created a Sunni army. That, why should we want to reverse that and integrate these people into an Iraqi army where the Shiites won't accept them and the Sunnis won't loyally serve?
So this idea, pipe dream that it may have been of getting everybody to intermarry, to not care who is what, is just totally out of reach?
Well, that never was the case. I mean, there was, among elites, there was a certain amount of intermarriage, but among very little between Kurds and Arabs, but between Sunnis and Shiites, there were some. But mostly people married within their own and lived within their own sect or within their own ethnic community. It never was a melting pot. It was always a country where people defined themselves by their religion or their ethnicity.
Let's talk a little bit about Turkey before we go to phone calls. You cite the fact that it used to be a strong ally of ours. The approval for Americans and American policy in Turkey was sky high, and it has sunk so low since this war. Just, we've lost all the support we ever had.
Well, it's stunning. First, we need to consider Turkey. It's the second most populous NATO ally of ours after Germany. It is located, couldn't be more strategic. To the west is the Balkans, the trouble spot of the 90s. To the north is the Caucasus, where Georgia and Russia fought a war this summer, and where there are a lot of other trouble spots. To the east is Iran. To the south is Iraq and Syria. And this was a country where, in the year 2000, Pew Charitable Trust did a poll, and 60% of Turks had a favorable opinion of the United States. They did another poll in 2006. And 7% of Turks had a favorable opinion of the United States. 83% had an unfavorable opinion. Now, when you consider that Turkey has been held out as a model of a secular, pro-Western country, Islamic country, it's not very helpful when your model hates you.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. Peter Galbraith is our guest, and he is author, well, his latest book is Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. He served as the first U.S. ambassador to Croatia. He's also the author of the bestseller, The End of Iraq, and is currently the senior diplomatic fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation and a contributor to the New York Review of Books. Our phone number lines are all busy right now, but keep trying. You'll get through. 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, John Katz will be joining us. He has a new book about the two new dogs in his life, Izzy. And he and Izzy become hospice volunteers. Some very moving stories. Actually, Izzy's story is pretty moving. And then when Izzy and John become hospice volunteers, the power of love from a dog, he writes about so beautifully. And Lenore, who's this puppy, black lab puppy, who's just nothing but love. John Katz is the person who makes me want to get a donkey, which maybe I will sometime. So that's coming up, hour number two. This hour, Peter Galbraith is with us. His latest book is Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. And we start our calls with Tom from Viroqua. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen, Mr. Galbraith.
Good morning, Tom.
The big headline news this morning is that U.S. troops just killed Abu Sara, or Abu Kashwara, as his other name goes by, who is supposedly the number two man in al-Qaeda. My first reaction was, oh, how convenient. you know, the night before the final debate on television. My second thought was, gee, it seems to me we've killed the number two person in Al-Qaeda, you know, several times before. I wonder who this guy is. So I just spent the last half hour on the web searching for Abu Sara and Abu Kashwara, and before 2 hours ago, this person does not exist on the web. It's almost like, 3 years into World War II, nobody ever heard of Goering or Himmler or something. It seems to me they create these guys, you know, and call them the number two. Of course, they're never the number one person in Al-Qaeda, but the number two person in Al-Qaeda, and then a very opportune time, kill him and make a big press release out of it, showing, oh, we're having victory.
Peter.
Tom, I appreciate your comments, but I don't agree with that. I don't think that these strikes are in any way timed to our political cycle. The military operates on the basis of its own intelligence, the information they have on the ground, and I've seen them in operation. Al-Qaeda in Iraq is a shadowy organization. Our intelligence about it's not necessarily very good. We may or may not know what the position of somebody will be. Of course, when we kill one of the leaders, and we did kill the number one leader, Zarqawi, in 2006, then there's a new leader who comes forward, or sometimes may just be invented. I think that this strike is the real thing. It's not something timed or something done for public relations purposes. But the larger point is that the success against Al Qaeda is, of course, something very welcome for the United States. But it is largely the result not of U.S. military action, but of the Sunnis turning against al-Qaeda, and the Shiite government now wishes to disband the Sunni militia that has brought the success we've had so far.
Thanks so much for the call, Tom. We go to Margie next from Franklin. Hi, Margie.
Hi. I'm very concerned about John McCain's temper and the fact that he talks about being a maverick, but it just seems like he always has to find a fight. And the way he is behaving towards Obama right now, it seems like when there weren't issues to talk about, he had to make a fight, and he's picking up a fight where there isn't one. And I'm concerned about how he would be as commander-in-chief in terms of picking a fight around the world where there isn't one. And I've seen on the internet where some of the generals say, well, if McCain was the one that at 3 o'clock that got the call and was going to push the button, that they wouldn't follow him because he is so knee-jerk and so angry.
Peter.
I've known Senator McCain for a number of years when I worked for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And when I was ambassador to Croatia, he was a visitor. I can remember one occasion where he certainly demonstrated a temper that was uncalled for. Nonetheless, I think he's a responsible individual. I don't think we need to worry that if he became president that he would push the button or act irresponsibly. I think that this election ought to be decided on the big issues. And when we look at the big issues, Senator McCain was an early booster of the Iraq War. He wants to continue the current strategy. He is pursuing goals in Iraq that are, in my view, completely unachievable. And that are a diversion from that take us away from addressing the real threats to our national security. Again, Iran, Pakistan and its nuclear program, the instability in that country. In Afghanistan, and again, and I also think he's wrong on the issue that worry Americans greatly, which is the economy, and that's the basis I think in which I would urge people to cast their vote, and we ought to get away from a lot of these diversionary issues, including the ridiculous ones that McCain has raised against Senator Obama, such as the supposed connection to, you know, when to Bill Ayers, who when he did his was a weatherman. Senator Obama was 8 years old. I mean, this kind of stuff is a diversion, and I don't think those tactics will work.
You talk about the fact that there should be agreement on one important national point. U.S. national security policy should be effective, and you suggest in the book steps that would contribute to a more strategic security policy. Can you talk more about that and also how both candidates have addressed the all-important issue of security?
Well, this is the key point, and I didn't write this book for Democrats or for liberals. I wrote it also for Republicans and conservatives. Whatever your philosophy is, you should want the United States to be effective, to be accomplishing our goals in the world. And the problem with how the Bush administration has conducted its foreign policy is that it has been ineffective. It has done great damage to the United States. We are less secure. Today, Iran and North Korea are much further along in their nuclear programs than they were in 2003, and our diversion in Iraq is one major reason. Pakistan, which has 60 nuclear weapons, is a very unstable country, and we're not addressing the problem there. Al-Qaeda and Taliban still operate in the tribal areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan, and we're losing in Afghanistan. So things are not going well. We've been ineffective, and one of the reasons we've been ineffective is we've substituted wishful thinking for hard-headed analysis, and so we've done that, so what I argue is that we should be strategic. Part of strategy is to prioritize. You have to understand you can't do everything in the world. So you pick the greatest threats to your security and the places where you are most able to be effective. That's where you apply your resources. You look at the situation on the ground. We should never be invading a country as we did Iraq and not know anything about the place that we're going into. And we need to get away from a government that's full of analysts and professionals who are just yes men and women, and instead have outliers who challenge some of the assumptions as part of the policy debate. And then when we deploy abroad, we should not only send the professionals in our military, but we should be sending professionals in the business of post-conflict reconstruction, professionals who know the region where we're operating. And it shouldn't be a playground for young conservatives or young members of a political party. I mean, this is serious business.
Thank you so much for the call, Margie. We go to Saeed from Green Bay. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, good morning, and thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted you to your speaker talked about the confrontation between Sunni and Shia in Iraq, and I wanted to bring your attention and solicit his opinion about another confrontation, which is the confrontation within the Shia world, which, in my judgment, is much more significant here. That is between that colossal confrontation of radicalism and modernity, which is represented on the one hand by the Iranian Khomeinists, and on the other hand by Iraqi ayatollahs like Sistani and dissident ayatollahs like Ayatollah Montazeri in Iran, who lives under house arrest. In the balance, for those in Iran who seek freedom, unfortunately, as some of your previous callers make my point here. Americans think about this conflict all in terms of, you know, our own political perspective. What does one move help one party versus the other? And that is not productive. What's productive here is to think in the region. What has happened? Iran and its surrogates in Hezbollah and Hamas have defeated political contenders in Lebanon, and they have defeated Israel. What makes us think that without our vigilant engagement in Iraq, Iran will not do to Iraq what it did to Lebanon?
Peter?
Saeed makes some very good points. But my argument, Saeed, is that this has already happened in Iraq, that the parties that dominate in Iraq are the parties that are closely aligned with Iran, and that they have already created in the parts of southern Iraq and parts of Baghdad, an Iranian-style theocratic government. And I'm afraid I disagree with your assessment of Sistani as representing this more modern view of Shiite Islam. In fact, on almost every issue, he has come down in favor of a theocratic government, and in favor of a role for the clergy, and has been the most important figure in Iraq in terms of the key decisions. He has not left us to the elected civilian government.
Thanks, Saeed, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Peter Galbraith is our guest, and his book is Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. Can we talk about money for just a moment here, Peter? This war certainly is costing us one ton of money, and considering all that's going on economically, I wonder what we do about this situation. Can we afford this war any longer?
Well, it has been very expensive, although in the context of our total GNP or even our total budget, it's not that huge. But sure, it is expensive, and we have other priorities at home that need addressing. But my main argument is that this war is damaging to our national security, because it means that resources that we should be using to deal with in Iran, that is pursuing nuclear enrichment, with Pakistan, with North Korea, are not being used for that purpose. We don't have a credible military option. I'm not advocating, incidentally, military strikes on any country, but it certainly helps when you negotiate if the other side thinks you have a credible military option. And with such a large part of our military tied down in Iraq, we don't have that credible military option. We don't have the financial resources that would enable us to do things that I think we need to strengthen this nascent democracy in Pakistan, whose success is going to be critical to our security. So it is in that sense that Iraq is a misprioritization of our national security resources. And incidentally, and some of your listeners, I'm sure, will not be happy to hear me say this, I argue that that the Iraq war has left most Iraqis better off. Most Iraqis, 80%, are either Shiites or Kurds. But it has left the U.S. much worse off. And in the end, the test of U.S. national security policy has to be whether it serves the interests of the U.S. and not whether it serves the interest of another country.
Pat from Madison, hi. Hi, Pat. No, I'm not sure where you are, Pat, so we'll try again. Ed from Lake Geneva, hi.
Oh, hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Before I get into my comments, I wanted to congratulate you on having such a great guest who is so extremely educated on the region and the situation. And perhaps, you know, the new and the next U.S. government, maybe they'd like to tap onto him and see maybe he will be willing to assist them a little bit.
Have you been asked by anybody to assist them, Peter?
I have a firm rule, which is I never turn down a job I haven't been offered.
And here's my comment. Saddam Hussein was a Sunni, and his government was Sunni. They, through the government and the military and the intelligentsia, they had the other section completely under control, the Shiites. So now that it's time for the Shiites to be in power, believe me, they are going to take power, and they're going to do their best to remain in power, even if that means, to a degree, you know, sort of like exterminating the other side. Now, I'm an ex-military person, and I have a lot of friends that have come from Iraq, and they've gone back, so I cannot share the names with you. And they're all officers as well. And here's what they tell me, which is absolutely incredible. He says, when you are in southern Iraq, you can tell easily who are the Sunnis, who are the Shiites. They're completely different. When you go to the north, you can tell the Kurds are completely different. And when we got there, they said to me, they were given no education whatsoever about what it is that these people are, their history, their language, their customs, how their religion, most importantly, their religion, because like the previous caller said about the conflict between the Sunnis, it's true. However, when it comes time to unite, due to their deep-rooted religions, they will come together again as Sunnis, and then later on, of course, they'll split up again trying to get the best of what they can get. So your guess is absolutely correct. We need to educate the American public. We need to educate all of us, exactly what it is that's going on today in Iraq. We are there already. We are there already. So we need to find a solution, an intelligent solution that will get all of this incredible mess fixed. It's not going to take overnight. It's not going to be done in 2 or 3 years. It's going to take a lot longer than any of us probably think it's going to take. But what we need to do first is understand clearly and put the resources, intelligent, experienced resources, as your guest, to go in there and give a guidance to someone. This is the way that it should be gone.
Thanks, Ed, for the call. What is the intelligent solution? There's the question of the hour. Peter?
Well, just to reinforce one of the points that Ed made, 6 weeks before before President Bush ordered U.S. troops into Iraq, he met with three Iraqi Americans who were strongly supportive of the war. And they got to discussing what would Iraq be like after Saddam Hussein was gone, and naturally they started talking about Sunnis and Shiites. And I know two of them well, so I have the story from two of them. President Bush was unfamiliar with these terms. And, of course, if you don't know that Islam has two main branches, you can't possibly understand that one of the unintended consequences of your war might be of your invasion might be a civil war between two groups that you did not know existed. And I don't cite this story to make a negative comment about President Bush or the state of his knowledge, although that might be fair. The real point is it demonstrates the lack of high-level thinking about what would happen after we went into Iraq, because clearly you couldn't have had this a presidential meeting on post-war Iraq without this issue of the Sunnis and Shiites coming up. That never took place. At this stage, we have to live with all these enormous mistakes, and we are not going to be able to change the fact that the Shiites have this 1,400-year history of feeling repressed at the hands of the Sunnis, an 80-year history in Iraq, a 35-year history of brutal repression by Saddam Hussein, which has all served to reinforce their identity, not as Iraqis, but as Shiites, and that the Sunnis cannot accept that Iraq is defined as a Shiite state, frankly, any more than a Protestant might accept that the U.S. would be defined as a Catholic state, even if that Protestant wasn't very religious. It is an exclusionary thing. So we have to work with that reality, and that's why the approach that's been put forward by Senator Obama and particularly by Senator Biden seems to me to be the one that makes the most sense. These three groups do live at this stage in geographically defined areas. Iraq's constitution, adopted by 80% of the Iraqi people, allows each region, each part of the country, to form its own region with virtually complete independence, the right to have their own armies. Let's encourage the Iraqis simply to implement the what is already provided in their own constitution.
You see, some of what you say just stops a person dead in his or her tracks. The fact that an administration would not know what the consequences between Sunnis and Shias would be and doesn't understand what the history is of these groups is just incredible. And I know from doing programs on this before the invasion, it was hard to find anybody who was in favor of this, and every person talked about the consequences. How can an administration we elect be so ignorant about something that results in chaos and death to Iraqis and Americans? I just don't understand that, Peter.
It is the most incompetent major U.S. government undertaking in my lifetime and probably in the history of our country. It is inexcusable. And the issue is not ignorance. The issue is, because we've had presidents and some of the top leaders who are not particularly well-informed, it is the lack of planning. It is the fact that these people didn't think it was important to plan for what would happen the moment they took Baghdad in a serious way. They chose the man to administer Iraq, Jerry Bremer, who was a disaster. But in fairness to Bremer, he was not chosen until 3 weeks after we got into Baghdad, and he was sent there 2 weeks after he was chosen. He had no background in Iraq, no background in a post-conflict situation, no time to prepare. And that really is the fault of the administration. It is a kind of incompetence that is so different from how we operate in the 1990s in the Balkans, where I served as a U.S. ambassador when we negotiated ends to the Croatia and Bosnia wars, where we had a lot of expertise. We did a huge amount of planning. We had limited and achievable goals. We ended those wars, and in all the period, now it's been 14 years, not a single American or NATO soldier has died in hostile action.
Thanks, Ed, very much for the call. Let's go to Mohammed next from Madison. Hi, Mohammed.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
You know, I've been disappointed that the Iraq discussion has pretty much been taken off the table for the most part, other than Senator McCain, bringing up the issue of the surge. And although Senator Obama has crafted a pretty articulate response, basically going back that we shouldn't have went there in the first place, to me, he could have done much further in just deflating this argument based on much of what the gentleman, your guest, has said. It sort of reminds me, like, if you put a police car with two policemen in front of every bank in the United States, you'd probably see bank robberies go down. Wouldn't mean that bank robbers wouldn't still be trying to figure out a way to rob banks. So to me, that's what the surge is. I mean, we found the same success trying to use a surge in gang neighborhoods. eventually the police have to go away. So I've been disappointed that has been somewhat taken off the table. The other thing is, the gentleman saying, is that as a Muslim, almost every educational program I have ever been in brings up the issue between Sunnis and Shia. 1,300, 1,400-year-old disagreement that is, I don't see to the last day of time this will be settled. How are people going to come in who know nothing about this and don't know the people and invade these people and set one minority that used to be in control out of power and put these other people in power? How are you going to resolve that?
Peter.
Well, I certainly agree with the thrust of what Mohammed has been suggesting. You cannot proceed when you don't know the terrain that you're dealing with, and with regard to the campaign, I certainly don't think we should let the notion go forward that the surge is a success. That really has not been a challenge, and to me the main point that needs to be challenged is that we're not achieving our objective. Stated objective, Senator McCain's stated objective of an Iraq as a democratic ally, and nobody's asking him, okay, do you believe that the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawah are democratic parties committed to the kind of values that you represent? Is this your idea of democracy? When we brought the awakening back in the Sunni areas, who were these people? They were Baathists. Does Senator McCain believe that the Baathists, the people we overthrew, we invaded Iraq in 2003 to overthrow, that those people are now Democrats and people who represent our values, for which we should be spending $700 billion in taxpayer money and committing our young men and women, that those are the people that represent our values? But that question hasn't been posed to him. He simply asserts that we're on the path to victory without explaining how he would get rid of the Iranian influence, how he would make the Shiite religious parties democratic, whether he believes the Baathists are now reformed, or how he would reform them if he doesn't believe that.
Peter Galbraith is our guest this hour. His book is Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies. He's the former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, the author of a New York Times bestseller, this may well be as well, The End of Iraq, and is the senior diplomatic fellow at the American Center, at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, and a contributor to the New York Review of Books. More phone calls and an interesting email coming up. 800-486-8655 is the number. Mohammed, thanks for your call. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up following the news from National Public Radio, John Katz has a new book. It's Izzy and Lenore, Two Dogs, An Unexpected Journey, and Me. John Katz with us, the second hour of our program. Peter Galbraith is here now. Peter, here's an email from David in Menominee. Afghanistan seems to be having all the makings of another unwinnable Middle East conflict, even as Obama and others argue that it's the central front on terrorism and needs more military power to control. No foreign nation has ever been able to subdue Afghanistan in the long term. It seems we're only trying to keep the Taliban from reasserting control over the country against the unpopular Karzai government. What's your take on that almost forgotten war on terror?
I agree that it is the central front on the war on terror, and part of the reason we're in the mess that we're in is that we took our eye off of the ball in 2001. We didn't send enough troops into Afghanistan at a time when our presence was welcome, when we could have decisively defeated the Taliban, when we could have captured or killed Osama bin Laden. So instead, we ended up working with the Afghan tribes, who have a long tradition of accepting money from both sides. We didn't know that, and so when Osama bin Laden was held up in Tora Bora Mountains, we hired tribesmen to go after him. They accepted our money, they accepted his money, and they let him go. And we are now in the mess that we're in. We clearly have a national interest in preventing the Taliban from returning, but we're going to have to work to find ways to broaden support for the Afghan government or to end up with a government that is more inclusive. And we're going to have to work with Pakistan, which is the country that helped create the Taliban in the 1990s and where elements of the virtually independent Pakistani ISI, Inter Services Intelligence, their equivalent of the CIA, continues to support the Taliban. There is a new democratic government in Pakistan. It's led by the widower of Benazir Bhutto. It's very much committed to the fight against terrorism, partly because the president is himself a victim of terrorism, losing his wife. This is an opportunity, and we need to seize it. Hmm. But there's no guarantee of success.
You went to school with Benazir Bhutto, didn't you?
Yes, I did. She was one of my closest friends from the day we met on the first day of freshman year.
Oh my. Let's go to Pat now from Madison. Hi, Pat.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
All right, Pat. How are you?
I am good. If I could quickly address just a point from an early caller and then a comment on the topic at hand here. I guess as far as the William Ayer situation, it's nobody's saying that Barack Obama believes what he does, or it was the fact that he was 8 years old when these bombings happened. The point I think people are asking, and what we're trying to make is, you know, William Ayers, you know, Reverend Wright, Acorn. There's a number of different associations here, and it seems to speak more about the judgment, the folks that he's willing to surround himself with. And it's not that we're saying that he believes necessarily everything that's going on, but is this the type of individual that you want leading the country?
All right, Pat, could we go now to the Middle East, to Iran, Iraq?
The topic at hand, I guess my point is, you know, I understand what the guest is saying, and it's a lot of the talking points that have been rehearsed over and over and over. My point is this, you know, we got into the war for weapons of mass destruction. They weren't there for a variety of different reasons, including intelligence errors. I guess my point would be, you know, we're talking about the destabilization of some of our allies and, you know, we've ruined our reputation and that type of thing. I would say that speaks a little bit more towards them than necessarily us as well. It seems like in the past we've always been probably the, you know, has come to the aid of those allies before anybody else, and it's going to happen again in the future. I would say the one time we, you know, strike unilaterally, it's all of a sudden we lose all this support.
All right, Pat, thanks very much for the call. And what about this? You write pretty movingly about this. What in the world has happened to our support? As a result of Iraq, people just don't think very highly of us. We're not a nation held in high esteem. Is that their fault, do you think, Peter, as our caller suggests?
No. The fact is that we've never had a president viewed with such contempt, with such distaste as George W. Bush, and that should not be a source of comfort to any Democrat in the country. It is a national problem, and it has affected the prestige of the United States. we adopted an approach toward the rest of the world that was my way or the highway. We've ignored the opinion of other countries. So when it came, for example, to the Kyoto Protocol, we said international law wasn't important. And it turned out that other countries said, oh, it's my way or the highway. Well, you take the highway. And as a result, we've had to burden the cost of this war in Iraq by ourselves. We have much less ability. We've been much less ability to influence events in Iran, to build an effective coalition, to deal with their nuclear program. This approach, I'm not arguing the rights or wrongs of it in terms of any moral or ethical point. It's been ineffective. It has hurt the United States. And it doesn't do any good for us to sit there and say, are our allies to blame? Are we to blame? That's a separate question. I look at this from the perspective of a person who's interested in the national security of the United States, and when I see something that doesn't work, that's ineffective, that's what we need to change.
Peter, thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for the book.
Well,
enjoyed
Kevin,
it. Thank
very
you.
Good talking to you.
Peter Galbraith, the book is Unintended Consequences, How War in Iraq Strengthened America's Enemies, published by Simon & Schuster. And he is the former U.S. ambassador to Croatia, also the author of The End of Iraq. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing the program, to Rhonda Fanning for producing here in Milwaukee, and thanks for all of your calls on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.